The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the December 8th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week has a Ebenezer Scrooge-looking character in his heavy winter coat and red scarf, top hat, and he's got a real scowling look on his face. In his left hand, he's got a tight grip on a big, looks like a heavy bag of money with a dollar sign on the front. And in his right hand, reaching out towards the foreground, he's got a single dollar bill. And the title is Your Next Raise. Will corporate tax cuts trickle down to workers? And with that, we'll go to the main stories and how they were covered. GOP tax bill advances. What happened? Republicans this week moved a big step closer to a major rewriting of the tax code after several holdout senators said party leaders had largely assuaged their concerns. The Senate Budget Committee voted along party lines on Tuesday to send the $1.5 trillion tax package to the floor. The plan, which is opposed by every Democratic senator and will need at least 50 of the 52 Republicans to vote yes, slashes the corporate rate from 35% to 20% and lowers the top individual rate from 39.6% to 38.5%. It provides temporary cuts ranging from $244 to $1,200 a year to some, but not all, individual taxpayers in 2019. In subsequent years, those cuts will dwindle and even turn into tax hikes for 50% of middle-class earners. The Senate's proposal helps pay for the corporate tax cuts by completely eliminating state and local tax deductions for individuals, but unlike the House bill, it preserves a deduction for medical expenses and the $1 million mortgage interest deduction. It also repeals Obamacare's individual mandate, which requires all citizens to have health insurance. Republican leaders made several compromises in a bid to win over the more than half dozen GOP holdouts. To placate Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, and other deficit hawks over the bill's cost, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he'd add a trigger that would eliminate some cuts if revenues don't meet expectations. Trump assured Maine Senator Susan Collins he'd back measures to stabilize Obamacare if the tax bill passed, to assuage her fears over eliminating the individual mandate. Every compromise and concession, however, faced resistance from other GOP senators. McConnell said lining up the 50 votes he needed was like sitting there with a Rubik's Cube. What the editorial said: of all the lies the GOP tells, said the New York Times, the biggest whopper is that their tax reforms would generate so much growth they would pay for themselves. Of 38 leading economists surveyed by the University of Chicago, only one said this was true. Another falsehood is that this is a middle-class tax cut. While the corporate tax cuts are massive and permanent, half of all Americans will, in fact, be paying more taxes by 2027, according to an analysis by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. The CBO always underestimates how much tax cuts spur growth and revenue, said the Wall Street Journal. The organization based its score on GDP growth of only 1.9% a year, way below the U.S. historical norm of 3.4%. Sure, the GOP's proposal has its imperfections, but in the end, we must bring the corporate rate into line with those of other developed nations if we are to escape the slow growth and stagnant wages of the last 11 years. What the columnist said. This bill exposes President Trump's phony populism, said Dylan Scott in Vox.com. After running on a promise to lower taxes for the poor and middle class and raise them for the wealthy elites like himself, he is backing a plan that does the exact opposite. The only reason Republican lawmakers are passing a bill supported by just 25% of voters is to keep their wealthy donors happy. Representative Chris Collins of New York even admitted his donors had told him, "Get it done or don't ever call me again." Trump's low approval ratings mean that anything with his name attached to it will be unpopular, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. But passing this bill is a wise decision for Republicans. As corporations use their tax savings to grow, the economy will pick up, wages will rise, and the GOP will reap the political benefits before next year's election. Republicans are clearly desperate to score a major legislative victory before the year ends, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. But the legislation they're frantically amending and rushing through is full of glitches. The bill's territorial tax system for corporations will reward companies for shifting more, not less, of their operations abroad, and wealthy individuals will find it extremely easy to gain the new 25% rate on pass-through businesses, thereby dodging higher individual rates. Republicans could easily take the time to properly vet and craft this legislation. Instead, they're racing to outrun the truth. Before we leave this page, I'll read you one of the It Wasn't All Bad shorts. Jose Andres may run an empire of restaurants, but the most important meals he serves are free. The Michelin-starred chef landed in Puerto Rico just 5 days after Hurricane Maria devastated the island and began cooking stews and paella for people who had lost their homes. Despite the lack of electricity, Andres set up a network of 20 kitchens across the island, including one hub in the parking lot of a stadium, that have served 3 million hot meals and sandwiches to those in need, more than any other aid agency. "It's a very simple thing when you're a cook," said the Spanish-born Andres. "You begin cooking, and then you start feeding people." The controversy of the week, Trump, why he picked a fight with LeVar Ball. Have you noticed that President Trump regularly goes out of his way to attack prominent African Americans, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. It's no accident. Trump was elected largely because of his skill in exploiting the feeling that minorities enjoy special privileges that unfairly rig the game against struggling white people. To remind his base why they love him, the 45th president has used his Twitter bludgeon to attack NBA superstar Stephen Curry, ESPN anchor Jemele Hill, U.S. Representative Frederico Wilson, and black NFL players who kneel during the national anthem. Last week, Trump found a juicy new target in LeVar Ball, the self-promoting basketball patriarch and aspiring apparel tycoon. Ball earned the president's ire when he refused to thank Trump for interceding to have charges dropped against his son, LiAngelo Ball, who was arrested along with two college basketball teammates for shoplifting in China. "Ungrateful fool," Trump raged in a tweet storm, adding, "I should have left them in jail." As president, Trump should have far, far, far better things to do than pick fights with ungrateful black athletes and their prominent and other prominent African Americans, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. But he'd rather throw chum to the worst part of his base. Mr. President, we see what you're doing, and we pity you. Don't pity him too much. Racial resentment put Trump in the White House, said Van Newkirk in TheAtlantic.com. Trump is a savant at harnessing white resentment and hostility toward outspoken people of color. He launched his political career on the racist birther campaign against President Obama. And as a presidential candidate, he exploited animus toward Hispanics and Muslims. Trump's policy views are largely incoherent, so there is no Trumpism without people of color to serve as a foil. The rest of America is growing increasingly disenchanted with his antics, which is why Trump is spending even more time knocking down the kinds of black folks members of his base want to see knocked down, like the flamboyant big-mouthed ball. Look, it was inexcusable of Trump to suggest he should have let the young ball and his teammates rot in a Chinese prison, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. But of all the people targeted for a presidential Twitter rant, LeVar Ball probably had it coming more than most. Trump personally asked Chinese President Xi Jinping to release LiAngelo Ball, thus sparing the younger Ball years in jail and keeping alive his dreams of a pro basketball career. Is a little humility, gratitude, and graciousness from his father really too much to ask? As for Trump's supposed racism, said Bill Sparrows in BostonHerald.com, how do critics explain his Twitter attacks on 100 white targets, ranging from Jeb Bush to Senator Chuck Schumer to Joe Scarborough? Trump may also attack whites, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com, but he exhibits a greater intensity of grievance when attacking black Americans, especially those he can accuse of ingratitude. Ungrateful, a slightly sanitized synonym for uppity, encodes the racist idea that whites have a natural right to the country, while non-whites have provisional status that depends on whether they prove they belong and show deference. Trump demanded Obama's birth certificate because he was a provisional American who'd stepped out of his place. With his attacks on famous uppity blacks like Ball, Trump is reassuring his supporters that after 8 years of a black interloper running the country, there's a new sheriff in town, and he is going to keep everyone in their place. And it was a good week for George H.W. Bush, who this week passed Gerald Ford's record of 93 years, 165 days, to become the longest living former president in U.S. history. It was a good week for the word complicit, which was named 2017's Word of the Year by Dictionary.com. It means choosing to be involved in an illegal or questionable act, especially with others. And it was a good week for losers, with the imminent opening in Los Angeles of the Museum of Failure. The museum will feature more than 100 failed inventions, such as Google Glass, and is intended to help humanity accept failure, learn from it, and truly achieve progress. But it was a bad week for delusions, with reports that President Trump has told a Republican senator and aides he's no longer sure it's his voice on the infamous Access Hollywood tape, bragging about grabbing women by the blank. It was a bad week for the gender binary after a Canadian teachers group invited members to attend a class on how to show sensitivity toward their LGGBDTTTIQQAAPP peers and students. Space does not permit a full unpacking of the acronym, but it includes demisexual, two-spirit, and pansexual. Finally, it was a bad week for U.S. Representative Joe Barton, 68, after a graphic nude photo of the Texas Republican went viral on the internet. Barton said he sent the photo and embarrassing caption to a former girlfriend during the breakdown of his second marriage, adding, "I am sorry I did not use better judgment." We're on the briefing page now. The topic is Immigration Agents Unleashed. Immigration arrests have soared under President Trump. Who is being swept up in the raids? What's changed? President Trump has given federal agents free rein to aggressively enforce the nation's immigration laws. The Obama administration deported 2.7 million people over 8 years, but focused on undocumented immigrants convicted of serious crimes and recent immigrants caught at the border, while mostly ignoring undocumented immigrants already living peacefully in the U.S. Trump has done away with such distinctions. Within 5 days of taking office, Trump signed an executive order instructing government agencies to target for removal anyone who has committed a chargeable criminal offense, including entering the U.S. illegally. Then Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly followed up with a memo stating that his agency would no longer exempt classes or categories of removable aliens. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE or ICE, agents made 75,045 arrests during the first half of this year, up 40% from 2016. If you're in this country illegally and you committed a crime by entering this country, you should be uncomfortable, acting ICE Director Tom Homan told Congress in a hearing. You should look over your shoulder. Who's being arrested? ICE agents still target known criminals in their raids on workplaces and homes, but are now arresting any undocumented immigrants they encounter in those raids. During a series of July raids in which ICE arrested 650 people, 70% weren't targets of the raid, but were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. ICE is also going after low-hanging fruit, undocumented immigrants known to agents. This includes the 1.8 million undocumented immigrants who have been granted a stay of deportation for medical or family reasons, provided they show up for semiannual check-ins with ICE agents. Some of them are now being arrested at their check-ins. In one widely publicized case, Guadalupe Garcia de Reyes of Phoenix, a mother of two U.S.-born children who has lived in the U.S. for more than 20 years, was detained at her annual check-in and deported to Mexico the next morning. How are immigrants responding? There's widespread fear in immigrant communities, with many going deeper underground to avoid the possibility of getting caught up in ICE's web. "We're terrified of being separated," said Natalie Uribe, a 22-year-old DACA recipient whose parents are undocumented. "We live in daily anxiety and terror of being deported." At one high school in Durham, North Carolina, enrollment dropped 20% after a student from Honduras was arrested on his way to school. It's still against ICE policy to raid sensitive locations such as schools and hospitals, but emboldened agents are pushing the envelope. In one case, Border Patrol agents arrested a 10-year-old girl while she was in an ambulance on the way to the hospital to receive emergency surgery related to her cerebral palsy, with armed guards placed outside her hospital room. They spent so much time and resources to follow this girl, to treat her like she was the highest priority criminal that ever walked on this earth, said Priscilla Martinez, an immigration activist. What's the justification for that? Immigration agents say they're just following the law. Lawmakers should have the courage and skill to change the laws if they don't like what they require, Kelly said in April. Otherwise, they should shut up and support the men and women on the front lines. Many immigration agents feel unshackled, according to several news stories, with the unions representing ICE and the Border Patrol reporting soaring morale now that the federal government isn't micromanaging whom they arrest. Is Trump's strategy working? That depends on the goal. The pace of illegal immigration to the U.S. has slowed dramatically, at least partly because of the perception that this administration is serious about deporting those who are caught. But while arrests are up, the U.S. is actually on pace to deport fewer people this year than under the last year of Obama's presidency. The surge of arrests has badly overloaded the already strained immigration courts, which now face a staggering backlog of 630,000 cases. The Trump administration is making a push to hire more immigration judges, but it could be years before many of those awaiting a hearing exhaust all of their appeals. Does ICE's campaign face other obstacles? Yes, at the state and local level. At least 15 states have taken up sanctuary legislation this year, which would limit local authorities' cooperation with federal immigration agents. California has gone the furthest, formally declaring itself a, quote, sanctuary state, unquote. This means state and local agencies will not comply with requests from ICE agents to hold undocumented prisoners until they can be arrested, or notify them about when they will be released. At least 142 jurisdictions nationwide have refused such requests, according to ICE. This is significant because an estimated 65% of all deportations result from cooperation between state and local law enforcement and federal immigration agents. Trump has moved to cut off federal law enforcement funds for sanctuary cities, but his executive order was recently blocked by a federal district judge. In the end, the contest of policy and wills may be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it's our time to read a few of the best columns from the week. We'll take two from the U.S. this week. The first comes from Connor Friedersdorf at theatlantic.com. Project Veritas, biggest expose yet. Project Veritas set out to prove that the Washington Post prints fake news, said Connor Friedersdorf. Instead, it showed how real journalists and a great newspaper really work. Right-wing activist James O'Keefe, who founded Project Veritas to conduct undercover stings designed to embarrass journalists and liberal organizations, recently tried to trick the Post into running a fake story about Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore. A woman named Jamie Phillips contacted the newspaper, claiming that when she was 15, Moore impregnated her and then took her for an abortion. Phillips was actually a Project Veritas plant sent by O'Keefe, who assumed drooling Post reporters would jump on the sensational story and print it, and reveal their animus toward Moore during interviews Phillips covertly videotaped. The premise proved incorrect. The Post assigned multiple staffers to vet Phillips' story, grew suspicious, and turned up evidence that her story was bogus and that she worked for Project Veritas. Instead of conceding that the Post passed his test, O'Keefe used his humiliating failure as an excuse to ask conservative donors for more funding. In 2016, O'Keefe paid himself an eye-popping salary of $317,691 for his, quote, nonprofit work as a partisan hatchet man. As we now know, it's nothing but a big con. David Von Drell at the Washington Post writes, we need younger presidents. Abraham Lincoln was 52 when he became president. Teddy Roosevelt was 42. And Franklin D. Roosevelt was 51. Harry S. Truman was 60. John F. Kennedy, 43. If most of our best presidents entered office at an average age of 60, said David Von Drell, why am I reading about potential candidates for 2020 who will be in their 70s? Our current president, Donald Trump, is the first to take office as a septuagenarian. If he runs for re-election at 74, his Democratic opponent could be Joe Biden, who will be 78 in 2020. Bernie Sanders, who will be 79, or Elizabeth Warren, who will be 71. Do we really want to give the nation's most demanding job to someone nearing 80? Yes, age and experience can produce wisdom, but science has found that mental agility, executive function, and creativity all decline as people age, especially beyond 70. In addition, older people tend to cling to ideas and strategies they adopted decades ago, with less capacity to embrace new information and innovate. We baby boomers have run the country long enough, and the many problems we're leaving behind call for leaders at the peak of their creative and conceptual powers. It's time to pass the torch. And this is an international column, one of the How They See Us features. This one called Abandoning Asia to China. Is U.S. President Donald Trump prepared to cede the entire South China Sea to Beijing, asks Murray Hebert in the Nikkei Asian Review from Japan. China has territorial disputes with five countries over these waters and has been bolstering its dubious claims by building artificial islands and equipping them with airfields, radar installations, and missile shelters. Just before Trump's November trip to the region, China unveiled a powerful new dredging vessel that can collect nearly 212,000 cubic feet of sand from the seabed every hour and move it away to create new land features. Yet Trump said barely a word about China's outrageous behavior, presumably out of hope that he could get more help from Beijing on North Korea's nuclear program. Without U.S. support for their claims, Taiwan and Vietnam may end up following the lead of the Philippines, which has apparently decided to trade its maritime territory for promises of Chinese investment. If Trump fails to challenge Beijing, the Chinese military will turn the South China Sea into a Chinese lake within the next decade or two. Trump is deluded if he thinks China will solve North Korea for him, said Sushil Seth. Yes, Chinese President Xi Jinping recently tightened sanctions on Pyongyang, but if China, North Korea's main sponsor and trading partner, were to get any tougher, the regime in Pyongyang would collapse, sending a flood of desperate refugees into China and eventually leading to the reunification of the Koreas and to U.S. bases on Chinese borders. It just won't happen. Even though Trump has talked up his great chemistry with Xi, he's made no gains on any key issue. Not North Korea, not trade, not the South China Sea. But Trump has made a huge concession, offering China a shared role with the U.S. to manage world affairs. China could not have hoped for a better president. America's allies were told that Trump would take on China, said Hugh White in the Straits Times from Singapore. The administration gave clear signals ahead of the president's Asia trip that he would emphasize the four Pacific democracies that make up the Quad, the U.S., India, Australia, and Japan, as a counterpoint to China. But he mentioned the Quad just once, and rather than criticizing China, Trump seemed happy to let Beijing become the region's leading power in America's place. That's a big problem for Australia, said the Australian Financial Review in an editorial. China is our largest trading partner, but it is not our friend. Yet even as we find ourselves newly vulnerable, our staunchest ally, Washington, has retreated from its alliance obligations into America First self-interest. In ignoring human rights and trashing trade treaties, Trump has abdicated the global leadership that has underpinned a generation of rising regional prosperity. Australia's task, then, is to convince Trump that retreat or protectionism will bring only new dangers for all. The last word feature this week is titled Inside Fort Botox. The lab where wrinkle-erasing wonder drug Botox is made is shrouded in secrecy, said writer Cynthia Coons. That's because the process involves a toxin so deadly that a single crystallized gram could kill 1 million people. There's no easy way into Allergan's Botox laboratories in Irvine, California. And once you're inside, there's no quick way out. But first things first. Here's a waiver acknowledging that within 18 to 36 hours of entering the secured labs, you could develop symptoms including double vision, difficulty speaking, arm or leg weakness, and eventual paralysis of your respiratory system. Try not to worry. Assume you sign the form and move on. The initial entryway is fitted with key card activated doors, beyond which are more doors guarded by pin pads, followed by still more key card entry points and more pin pads. There are only a few people at work or walking around. Deep inside, behind double-paned windows, are still more glass barriers and finally, metal enclosed workstations. Everything is under video surveillance. All activity is measured and monitored. Guards watch the comings and goings from a room filled with banks of screens. All of this scrutiny and precaution isn't there to protect Allergan's wildly popular drug from competitors, though it's worth protecting. Last year, Botox generated $2.8 billion in sales. Rather, the security exists because the drug that can take years off a person's appearance by erasing wrinkles also happens to be made with one of the most toxic substances known to science. Botox is derived from a toxin purified from Clostridium botulinum, a bacterium that thrives and multiplies in faultily canned food and sometimes prison-made booze. The botulinum toxin is so powerful that a tiny amount can suffocate a person by paralyzing the muscles used for breathing. It's considered one of the world's most deadly potential agents of bioterrorism and is on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's select agent list of heavily regulated substances that could pose a severe threat to public, animal, or plant health. Because of that, Allergan must report to the CDC if even a speck of the toxin goes missing. And when it's sent to Allergan's manufacturing facility in Ireland, its travels bring to mind a presidential Secret Service operation. A baby aspirin-sized amount of powder toxin is enough to make the global supply of Botox for a year. That little bit is derived from a larger primary source, which is locked down somewhere in the continental U.S. No one who isn't on a carefully guarded list of government and company officials knows exactly where. Occasionally, the company won't say how frequently. Some of the toxin, the company won't say how much, is shipped in secrecy to the lab in Irvine for research. Even less frequently, a bit of the toxin is transported by private jet with guards aboard to the plant in Westport, Ireland. Scientists differ on how much of the toxin would be required to inflict massive damage. Data on the topic is scarce, and that may be intentional. But a study published in 2001 in the Journal of the American Medical Association said that a single gram in crystallized form, evenly dispersed and inhaled, would kill more than 1 million people. The mere possibility of a botulism bomb has the U.S. government on edge. That puts Allergan in a remarkable position. The government's vigilance enhances the company's own secrecy, and together they give Botox a near monopoly that is almost unassailable. Allergan says Botox has more than 90% of the market for medical uses of neurotoxins and 75% of the market for cosmetic uses. I used to say, how often do you see that distribution of market share in any category, not just drugs, just in anything, says David Pyatt, chief executive of the company from 1998 to 2015. People used to laugh and say, I see what you mean, because it's just unheard of. There are hundreds of botulism poisonings annually in the U.S. alone, and a couple of times a year someone dies. In a typically random case, a man passed away earlier this year after eating tainted nachos at a gas station outside of Sacramento. It was the cheese sauce. Around 1820, Justinus Kerner, a German doctor and poet famous for his supernatural and melancholy romantic verse, published the first accurate description of the symptoms of what he termed Wurstgift, or sausage poisoning. Drooping eyelids, accompanied by difficulty swallowing and breathing. Near the end of the century, a group of musicians playing at a funeral developed double vision and muscle paralysis after eating a ham. At least three died. From that tragedy, Emil van Immergem, a microbiology professor in Belgium, identified C. botulinum. He is credited with giving the pathogen its name, deriving it from the Latin word for sausage, botulus. U.S. government concern about the weaponization of botulinum isn't fanciful. After prodding by United Nations inspectors, Iraq admitted to refining large quantities of the toxin prior to 1991 for use in some of its 25 Al-Hussein warheads, part of the biological weapons program. Earlier, fears that Nazi-era Germany had a stockpile of botulinum led to the development of a vaccination for Allied troops. It was readied in advance of D-Day, but intelligence reports ruled out the use of botulism-tipped weapons, and the vaccine wasn't administered. It was also during World War II that the U.S. started studying the toxin for biological weapons of its own, work that indirectly led to the creation of Botox. Botox is largely the brainchild of two scientists, Alan Scott and Ed Schontz, who approached the toxin with completely different goals. In the 1960s and 70s, Scott, an ophthalmologist, was looking for a treatment for people with strabismus, or crossed eyes. Schontz's focus was more military than medical. He's done work purifying the botulinum toxin in the chemical core at Fort Detrick in Frederick, Maryland, home of the U.S. Biological Weapons Program, before moving to the University of Wisconsin, where he perfected the process. Schontz became a supplier of the toxin to Scott after a colleague put the two in touch. Back then, controls for shipping botulinum were next to non-existent. Schontz sent the stuff in crystalline form to Scott via the U.S. Postal Service in a metal tube slipped inside another metal tube. It was Scott who turned the toxin into a pharmaceutical. He then formed a company around his breakthrough called Oculinum Incorporated. The drug, also called Oculinum, was approved in 1989 for strabismus and blepharorapism, or twitchy eyelid. Allergan licensed it from Scott, then bought it outright in 1991. The name was changed to Botox the next year. From the start, Allergan took a cautious approach to the substance it recognized had the potential for grave harm if misused. It's always been an issue. We've certainly known it's one of the most potent drugs in the world, said Gavin Herbert Jr., former longtime CEO and son of the company's co-founder. Mitchell Brin, Allergan's chief scientific officer for Botox, has played a critical role in the drug's development almost from the beginning. In the 1980s, he was a neurologist at Columbia University specializing in movement disorders. He and his colleagues got their supply from Scott, who'd gotten U.S. regulatory approval to evaluate the use of his drug on human subjects. Brin began testing it on patients with severe muscle contractions in the face, jaw, neck, and limbs. His awe over its power hasn't waned. He still enjoys showing old before and after films of patients whose spasm disorders were quelled by Botox in some of the earliest days of the drug. The drug works like this. A person's muscles are controlled by motor nerves, which release a chemical that instructs the muscles to contract. Botox blocks the release of that chemical. Today, it's approved for 9 different medical uses, including treatment for chronic migraines, overactive bladders, and severe muscle spasms, and is in trials for use in treating depression. It's also being studied for atrial fibrillation, or AFib. Cosmetic uses are likewise expanding. The next frontier is the saggy neck and the two-square jaw. Herbert says that when Allergan first acquired Botox, he thought it could do $10 million in annual sales. Now it's on track to grow to almost $4 billion by 2020. As is often the case with blockbuster drugs, Botox's story has a chapter on an entirely accidental discovery. It was a doctor couple, Jean Carruthers, a Vancouver ophthalmologist, and her husband, Alistair, a dermatologist, who stumbled on Botox's anti-aging properties. Jean was treating a patient with eye spasms. The woman protested at one appointment when she wasn't given a shot in her brow. She said injections in that spot gave her a beautiful, untroubled expression, Jean recalled in a TEDx talk in 2012. At the same time, Alistair was looking for a better treatment for deep frown lines. The two teamed up to examine the use of Botox in forehead creases. Their receptionist was the first patient. Within days, she had a smoother forehead and a refreshed, open, younger expression, as Jean puts it now. But finding customers willing to be injected in the face with poison wasn't easy. So Jean decided to use the drug on herself. Soon there was no shortage of takers. I haven't frowned since, she says, laughing. Full list price for Botox is roughly $600 per treatment, according to research firm SSR LLC, and this drug sells at full price more often than most. Roughly 55% of the business by revenue is for medical treatments. The other 45% is cosmetic procedures, which aren't covered by insurance. Patients pay full fare for the drug, plus what their doctor charges. It's probably from somewhere near Irvine that the botulinum toxin starts its journey to the plant in Westport. The company won't say where in Ireland the toxin makes landfall or how it makes its way from there to Westport. It never leaves Allergan's control, said Paul Coffey, general manager of Allergan's Westport facility. There would be a very small number of people who are aware of the shipment, and it would be a rare event. There can be a year or more between deliveries. The company has no concerns about our security processes despite the madness that's happening in the world at the moment, says Coffey. It just reminds us that if we were that if we ever were thinking we didn't need to have that kind of security, well, yes, you do. As for whether Allegan CEO Brent Saunders has ever visited Westport's most secure production area, or even has the clearance to enter, Coffey answers, absolutely not. If Saunders were to try, he'd start by turning off one of the few roads that lead out of Westport, looking for a small brown sign that bears the company name. It points down a narrow lane that gives way to a long, winding driveway. The toxin arrives along this lane, passing by a small building that houses a 24-hour security staff. Beyond that is a campus whose beautiful grounds are a testament to Herbert Jr.'s love of gardening, a facet of both the Westport and Irvine facilities. Herbert Jr., 85, retired in 1995 and is now, among other pursuits, an owner of Rogers Gardens, a home and garden center in Newport Beach, California. Coffey likes the security inside the facility, likens the security inside the facility to layers of an onion. Where we store our purified toxins is in the middle of the onion, he says. The storage room for toxin is monitored by cameras that, in addition to guarding the company's greatest asset, are used to help engineers diagnose equipment problems remotely. The rare few employees who have access to the room enter only after they've stripped off their street clothes and suited up in full surgical garb. From the core of this security onion, the toxin begins its trip back into the world, in a busy plant that employs more than 800 people. The first step is making the drug is to combine saline solution with an almost incomprehensibly minuscule quantity of the purified toxin. The liquid flows through a series of pipes into a sterile filling room. These rooms are monitored for temperature, humidity, differential pressure, non-viable particulates, and other factors. The company takes some 16,000 samples a month across these clean rooms to test for bacteria in the air. It's a largely automated process that's tracked by microscopic cameras embedded in the machinery. In the final steps, the saline solution is shot into tiny glass bottles and then reduced to a fine powder. Those bottles, individually boxed, are what doctors around the globe receive. One of the most feared substances on Earth is now largely neutered, immensely valuable, and ready to be injected into a wrinkled brow or a sweaty palm. No need for guarded private jets now. FedEx will do. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Bloomberg Businessweek. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The gospel singer who became a TV star, Della Reese, 1931 to 2017. Della Reese had a long and celebrated career as a jazz and gospel singer. From the 1950s to the 90s, the husky-voiced Detroit native headlined America's biggest nightclubs, sold millions of records, and frequently filled in for Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show. Yet it was as an actress that Reese became most famous, playing Tess, a wise but down-to-earth mentor of angels in the hit CBS drama Touched by an Angel, 1994 to 2003. For Reese, this transition from singing to acting came naturally. "Every time I sang the blues, I wasn't blue," she said. "I was already acting." Born into a poor family, Reese took early to people watching and to song, said the Washington Post. She sang about scenes unfolding outside her Detroit home, neighbors having affairs, a husband hitting a wife, until, she said, her mother had to nail up the window. Reese became the star soloist in a local junior gospel choir, and at age 13 went on tour with legendary gospel singer Mahalia Jackson. That gig would last for five summers. Her big break came in 1951, when Reese won a week-long singing residency at Detroit's Flame Show Bar, said the New York Times. 1 week turned into months, a manager spotted her, and she moved to New York City. Signed by Jubilee Records, Reese had her first Billboard Top 10 hit with the 1957 ballad, And That Reminds Me. She made her TV acting debut as a nightclub owner on the Mod Squad in 1968, and the following year helmed Della, the first national variety talk show to be hosted by a black woman. The show was canceled after one season, but Reese went on to star in scores of TV movies and series, including Chico and the Man and The Royal Family. Touched by an Angel had a slow start that almost led to cancellation, said the Los Angeles Times. But the show quickly grew into a major hit, with ratings in TV's top 10 for four of its nine seasons. Reese, an ordained minister who held services for her California congregation, even at the height of her success, never took her fortune for granted. My mom scrubbed floors, my dad poured steel, she said. I had no formal training, just a gift from God. I've been blessed. On the Talking Points page, we have corporate tax cuts. Will workers benefit? It's become a mantra for Republicans. If you cut corporate taxes, businesses will pay workers more, said Jim Pusagara and Don Lee in the Los Angeles Times. The White House has promised that cutting corporate taxes from 35 to 20% will lead to such a surge in growth and wages that the average household will receive $4,000 a year more. But most economists are far or less bullish. Corporate profits are already hovering near historic highs, and unemployment is near historic lows. Yet raises average an anemic 2.5%, and employee wages as a share of the economy have been trending down. Most of the benefits have flowed to shareholders via dividends and stock buybacks that enrich executives who get bonuses for higher stock prices. When White House economic advisor Gary Cohn recently asked a meeting of about three dozen CEOs how many plan to invest a tax windfall back in their businesses, only three raised their hands. Why, Cohn asked, aren't the other hands up? Maybe that's why the current Republican tax bill is one of the most unpopular pieces of legislation in modern history, said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com. Voters understand that the proposed tax cut overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy, which is why only 25% support it. Under the Senate's plan, nearly 50% of the benefits would go to the top 5% of earners in the first year. If lawmakers wanted a real middle-class tax cut, they could put money directly in people's pockets with a payroll tax cut or by expanding tax credits. Instead, they're rewarding their corporate and billionaire donors under the guise of trickle-down economics. Here we go again, said the Weekly Standard in an editorial. Every time Republicans try to cut taxes, Democrats cry, "You're favoring the rich and hurting the middle class." But our corporate tax rate is among the highest in the world, and once it drops, American companies will have more money to expand and hire. If that's true, why don't we put it to the test, said E.J. Montini in the Arizona Republic. The next time you see your boss, ask, "How soon after President Trump's tax plan passes can I expect my $4,000 raise?" If your boss doesn't drop dead laughing, you might even get a straight answer. And a few shorter notes as we wind down the hour. Starting with, let's see, Paul Manafort traveled to Moscow at least 18 times prior to joining the Trump campaign as an advisor and campaign manager, flight records and interviews reveal. He also made frequent contact with Vladimir Putin's allies during the years he worked for pro-Kremlin parties in Ukraine. Millennials who want to take part in the sustainable food movement are giving up desk jobs and buying small farms. For only the second time in the last century, the number of farmers under 35 years old is increasing, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's latest Census of Agriculture. 69% of the surveyed young farmers had college degrees, significantly higher than the general population. President Trump, who played golf four straight days over Thanksgiving weekend, has spent 81 days at his golf properties since he took office, nearly triple the number of rounds played by President Obama at this point in his first term. The White House generally refuses to confirm that Trump is golfing. Gun sales are soaring in the wake of recent mass shootings and talk of tightening gun regulations. The FBI received 203,086 requests for instant gun background checks on Black Friday, nearly a 10% increase from the year before and a new record for background checks on a single day. On the poll watch, 60% of American women say they have been sexually harassed. Of those who've been harassed, 69% say the harassment occurred at work, while 43% say that it happened in a social setting, and 45% on the street. 55% of American voters say people have a better understanding of sexual harassment due to the recent media attention on the sexual misconduct of elected officials and celebrities. And we'll finish out with a quote from Margaret Mead, quoted in thebrowser.com. She says, "We are continually faced with great opportunities, brilliantly disguised as unsolvable problems." We have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.